It's a delight to have John Patrick back at the microphone. If you don't know John or this is the first time you've heard him, his background is he was trained at King College in London. He was born and raised in the UK, did his clinical work at St. George's Hospital, held appointments in Britain, the West Indies, and Canada. Main academic interest has been in the treatment of protein energy malnutrition and accident trauma throughout the world. He even did research and lived for a number of years in the West Indies. Came to Canada in 1980 and was associate professor at the University of Ottawa for over 20 years. But he has a great interest in apologetics, has spoken to Christian and secular groups all over the world on medical ethics, culture, public policy, integration of faith and science. He speaks frequently not only for CMDA, but also the Christian Medical and Dental Society of Canada and our sister organizations all over the world. John and his wife, Sally, live in Canada. They have 4 grown children and 21 grandchildren. Their oldest daughter and her family are missionaries in Malawi, and the rest of their kids and grandkids live close to them around Ottawa. It's always a delight to have my good friend John Patrick with me at the microphone. We've got a great time in store. John, it's great to have you back on Christian Doctors Digest. Always a treat. You always challenge me. And today we're going to talk about a topic that foundations of life. Where are you going to go with that?
Well, when you look around, clearly the foundations are being shaken at the moment, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely.
I saw a figure the other day that 80% of incarcerated males in North America have had no father in their lives. And yet you have a leadership undermining marriage on every opportunity until relatively recently anyway.
Yeah, absolutely, because it's like committed marriages are just unnecessary. They're not needed. Do what feels good. Go with what you like to do. And boy, that has an impact on kids and ultimately our culture.
Yeah, and it's had an impact even on the way we in the evangelical wing of the church present the gospel, hasn't it? It can easily degenerate into a feel-good experience, whereas in actual fact, that certainly wasn't what Paul intended. I love misquoting Paul when I'm preaching to see if the congregation are alert. One of the favorite ones is to say, Paul, writing to the Corinthians, says, the preaching of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to those who have been saved, it is the power of God. And I have just trashed the cultural history of the Western world in one sentence, and it appears that none of you have noticed.
Explain.
Well, the error is small but vital. It's the verb. I misquoted by saying, but to those who have been saved, but it's not have been, it's are being saved. It's present continuous for Paul. And he frequently says to people, I know it's worth praying for you because your faith is alive. Now there are things to pray about.
Yeah.
We have lost that. I mean, have you ever heard a pastor on Sunday morning say, please, can we devote the prayers from the congregation this morning to people giving thanks for the ways in which they have been saved in the last week?
I never have.
No, nor I. And yet, it seems to me that's exactly what Paul wants. And as you look at the world at the moment, our Lord never set up a committee meeting. He gave no instructions on how to run institutions. He started with character. And it astonishes me more and more as I go back to it again and again and again that he says, look, the bottom line is you're a mess. So the first step forward is the happiness that comes from acknowledging that. Even Jordan Peterson says that. He says to audiences, wherever he goes, he says, we're all a mess. We know what is good, but we're not doing very well. And he's not yet a Christian, but he can't stay in that position for long. I mean, his feet are firmly planted on a rock which he hasn't yet recognized. But we're not doing anywhere near as good a job as he has. He is in getting to people who don't go to church and getting them to think what are really Christian ideas in, to a considerable degree. And he understands that. It's astonishing. I don't know whether I've spoken to you since I had the privilege of sharing a conference with him with a couple of others. Have I spoken to you since?
I don't think so. I don't think so.
Because it was astonishing, and I'm sure physicians listening will be interested, and it might provoke them into a bit more activity. It was last fall, but the invitation came about a year before that. And Sally said, "You've got an unusual invitation." And I said, "What is it?" She said, "Well, you've been asked by a Catholic family group to talk at a conference they're having, which is on the liturgy of life. It doesn't sound like you to me." I said, "No, but it's certainly an interesting opportunity. And I'd love to find out what it's like." So yes. Shortly afterwards, or a few months later, one of the organizers sent me a note, and it turned out that she knew of me through you, basically through Doctor's Digest tapes and CDs. And she said, "I just wanted to bring you up to speed. I was in Portland visiting a favorite priest of mine, and I was enthusing about our conference." And he said, "Well, tell me, who are the main speakers?" And she said, "Well, Jordan Peterson's the main one." And he said, "I've no idea who he is. Anybody else?" And she said, "John Patrick." He said, "Oh, I know him. I'll come." That's the only time in my life that I will have upstaged, at least in theory, Jordan Peterson. But I began to take some interest in him and was fascinated by what he had to say and what I think the Lord is doing to him. Anyway, the conference was really very interesting. And what was really striking, and he said it's the normal thing, is that there were a lot of young men there you don't expect at family conferences. And they'd come to hear Jordan Peterson. And when he'd finished a talk, there was a line of, you know, it took 45 minutes to get through. And he said, "Well, they just want to say thank you." How long is it since Christians have had people queuing up to say thank you for presenting the gospel? Mm. And what they like is his obvious concern that they're being sold a pup and abused intellectually. So he's concerned for them. His passion and his openness and his willingness to be politically incorrect. He's very clever at it. He never makes a statement without asking a question. He sets it up beautifully. I don't know if you've listened to him at all yet.
No, I've not. You're making me curious, though.
You have to. Particularly, you should go and put in Jordan Peterson in Britain, being interviewed by a feminist who's made her reputation by taking men apart, and he takes her apart. Mm. Her name has gone from me at the moment. That's a kindness. But it's 20 minutes or so in which she tries to take him apart, and it finishes with him realizing he's won. He says, "I've got you, haven't I?" And she said, "Yes, you have. I don't know what to say."
Wow.
And it went viral in the millions within a week. Mm. And he's now the most widely known public intellectual in the world, with millions of followers. He's got his own YouTube site, but you put Jordan Peterson into YouTube and you get dozens of things, lots of which will interest you. So close and yet still so far. And I said to him at the end of that conference, "You know where this pathway ends, don't you?" And he said, "Yes, but it's going to take a while to get there."
Hmm.
But he's so close. You know, he says the Logos is what is at the heart of what it means to be a human being. God created a world. No, he didn't say God created. He said the world we've been given is pregnant with possibilities, and Logos makes it possible, what we know in our souls.
Wow.
And he claims not to be a Christian. He's incredibly close. But he's got lessons for us about the passions that need to be understood. I mean, he stood up to the government and said, "You are attacking freedom of speech. No government can tell you what to think." Now, I was going to start this session with you, and I haven't, but I'll put it in now. I wanted to read something to you, which is a very famous 30-40 words by one of your most famous presidents. He wrote this: "Of all the dispositions and habits which lead to political prosperity, religion and morality are indispensable supports. In vain would that man claim the tribute of patriotism who should labor to subvert these great pillars of human happiness, these firmest props of the duties of men and citizens." Do you know where that comes from?
I was thinking either Washington or Lincoln, or there could be someone else.
It's Washington.
Yeah.
It's from his final speech, his final address, which apparently, I didn't know this, they read in the Senate every year. we should take more notice of it.
Yeah, boy, my goodness, yes.
But for us as evangelicals, the thing that's bothered me over the years is the recognition that Christ doesn't tell us to be successful evangelists. He tells us to go and witness to what Christ has done in our lives and to produce fruit that gives glory to God. There's a sense in which we're given the dignity of causality. People come to Christ, and we have an agency in that of some sort, and it's an incredibly great privilege that that should be so. But all we're required to do is bear witness and produce fruit. Mm-hmm. I think we've lost a bit of that, haven't we?
It's easy to, and you think it's performance-based. I've got to see certain results, where you don't realize that God does, the Holy Spirit does the work.
Yeah.
And your faithfulness, God allows you to be there sometimes when he does it, and many times not.
I mean, you must have the experience that I have of, as you travel around, people coming and saying to you, thank you so much, and you have no memory of what they're talking about.
Absolutely. In fact, it happened to me in India after I spoke, and all these people started coming up, and I'm going, I've never met you before. But, you know, through a book, through writing, through an audio recording, you know, it's just, you never, that's what the first million years of heaven's going to be, I think, is finding out all God did that you knew, had no idea what he was doing.
Oh, the interconnections are just amazing. And as Lewis puts, some, I think, in the Screwtape Letters, he has little interest in our wars and politics. They are of no eternal significance. So all the terrible things that are going on, yeah, he allows them. I mean, it's right there in the scriptures, isn't it? Is there evil in the city and the Lord has not done it?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he is a situationalist. He allows things which are awful to happen to us because, as it says in to me, the most frightening pro-life chapter in the Bible, where in Ezekiel, I think it's chapter 30 or thereabouts, where he's telling through Ezekiel the children of Israel, they've become idolatrous, they haven't recognized who he is, and he says, they're not keeping my Sabbaths. And so he says, I have allowed them to go astray. I have given them ways of living, idols that cannot support their life. I have caused them to offer their firstborn to Moloch, of course. And then he says, I did it to horrify them, that they might return to me. He doesn't mind how far he goes to horrify us if that's what's necessary.
Yeah.
I mean, you see it, and I've seen it. Some terrible disaster happens in Africa, and then you meet Christians who are in the middle of it, and suddenly say things like, well, yeah, I wouldn't wish this on anyone, but I have learned more about prayer and about God in the last few months than I have in the rest of my life.
Mm-hmm. God never wastes pain and suffering. He always uses them if you allow him to.
Yeah. So the question is, how do we get to the point where we become a more serious people again? I think we've become somber where we should be sober. But we should be sober and joyful, not somber and joyless. But our joy is a rational joy, you know, and he says, when you are persecuted, rejoice. That's a command. So it cannot be a feeling because we do not have the ability to command our feelings. So, but then he gives us two reasons. Look at the company you've joined and look at the reward in heaven. It's a rational reason for rejoicing in suffering. Paul knows it. He says, I want to complete the sufferings of Christ. This has to be mined. And something else I was looking at, just I'll read this too. This is Bonhoeffer's prayer that was written in the days before he was executed. In fact, it says shortly before his execution. And this is a prayer, by gracious power so wonderfully sheltered, and constantly waiting what may come. He knew what was coming. We know that God is with us night and morning, and never fails to greet us each new day. Yet in this heart, by its old foe tormented, still evil days bring burdens hard to bear. O give our frightened souls the sure salvation for which, O Lord, you taught us to prepare. And when this cup you give is filled to brimming, with bitter sufferings hard to understand, we take it thankfully and without trembling, out of so good and so beloved a hand. Yet when again in this same world you give us the joy we had, the brightness of your sons, we shall remember all the days we lived through, and our whole life shall then be yours alone.
Wow.
It's to write that, as you're about to have a piano wire around your neck, is quite something.
Yes, yes. And the poetry and the beauty of it and the surety, it just shines through.
And I sometimes don't want to pray because I don't think I can say anything that's adequate in the view of what other people have written when they prayed. You know, how often has prayer stopped you and given you a lump in your throat in church?
Mm.
It should, mm-hmm. I think. So the only solution must be that we have, in some sense, to repent and ask for mercy and guidance and the blessing of being able to do those things. I mean, he prepares people to do it, and those that can are being silent, I presume. I love two of my Old Testament favorite characters, Bezalel and Oholiab.
those aren't near the top of my list, but go ahead.
Well, they're on mine, so I'll explain why. When Moses is being given the instructions for making the tabernacle, I can put myself in Moses' shoes and say, well, I know what he was thinking. How am I supposed to do this? And God knows what he's thinking. And when he's let him suffer for a while, as he sort of takes it all down and makes notes or whatever he did, he says, oh, by the way, I have given the gifts that are required to Oholiab and Bezalel. They can make all these things that I have told you to do, including the Ark of the Covenant and everything else. But he had given the gifts to do it.
Mm-hmm.
It's all gifts. I mean, your incredible capacities to have a vision of something, as in Tenwick, and change a one-man band into the best teaching hospital in Kenya in, you know, less than 20 years. That was a gift, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was definitely the Lord.
You did a lot of work, but you knew that you were not alone in that.
Yeah.
That's what matters. That's what always matters. And I don't think we're modeling that sufficiently. In fact, even my wife has trouble when I say, I think we need to say the things that happened to us. She says, but it sounds so much like boasting. I said, well, I hope not. But this summer, for instance, I got two emails. And you're partially involved in this too. They're both from doctors, one in the Midwest and another in New Jersey. And they both were talking about a talk they'd heard 20 years before. Mm-hmm. Not in the same place, I don't think. They didn't say where, but it was what Hippocrates knew and we've forgotten.
Mm-hmm.
And both these two docs had remembered the four key points. And in this last year, they had come home to roost in a big way as they began to see how far medicine had fallen because of losing the sense that without God, we don't have any medicine. Without transcendence, it will fall apart because you have no reason to trust someone with your life if they don't fear judgment for that life after death. And so both these folks had reordered their lives in the last year to find somehow a place where they could practice medicine with those principles in place for as long as possible. Because I'm not sure how long the young are going to be allowed to do these things. We really do need to be thinking hard about how we set ourselves up to demand that we be treated with as much respect as any other minority in terms of having, if you're a rationalist and a nihilist, then the last act of your own volition is to say, kill me.
Mm-hmm.
Who can deny that to an atheist? But to insist that a Christian must do it is to fail to recognize what that would do to the Christian's story of meaning. And surely a Christian patient has as much right to know that the doctors caring for me will under no circumstances kill me as the other way around.
Yeah.
We so often try to argue our way into winning our position, whereas I think what we should be doing much more is telling our story and saying, doesn't our story have as much right to exist as yours? It's been around longer. It's got far less in the way of troubles attached to its name. You know, if you want to know who screwed the world up in the last century, they're all atheists. From the French Revolution on, the French Revolution, the Nazis, Hitler, Stalin, Lenin, Mao, Pol Pot, they were all totalitarian atheists and socialists, they said, who didn't care about people because they didn't understand what we should understand, as Lewis said, the holiest thing you meet every day is your neighbor. if you could see him or her as they will be in heaven, you would be tempted to worship.
Hmm.
But we're kept so busy, we don't have time to stand back and think about these things, do we?
No, or to act upon them either. I mean, I'm too busy. That's our excuse. And we are busy, but it's not an excuse.
Yeah. And we're seeing the whole thing being taken away from us because of that. Late, I've been reading quite a lot of stuff by a guy called Roger Scruton. I don't know if you've come across him. The book lying on my desk at the moment is called Confessions of a Heretic. It says on the front, "We individuals who have a deep suspicion of government have a yet deeper need for it. Government is wrapped into the very fibers of our social being," and he explains how that has happened. He's a brilliant writer, and at the end of it, he talks about defending our heritage. You know, the young people coming out of the arts faculty at the moment are taught to hate their own culture, to be saying mea culpa the whole time, and yet everybody wants to come and live in this mea culpa environment. They don't want to live elsewhere. Yeah, well, everybody screws up as Christians. We know that. We set out to do good and we do evil, and often we didn't intend it. But he at the end of the book, lists seven things which he says we need to think about seriously because they have made us who we are. And I doubt that most of us could put this all together. He starts with citizenship and says, "Law made legitimate by the consent of the people. Or submission to reveal law like Sharia? No. Common law, a residue of human agreements. For Muslims, no distinction between law and morality. Their rulers are often assassinated. The privatization of religion in the West is a miracle. The fact that we have, for all these years, held rights of religion actually sacrosanct until the last little while in the Western world. We're suffering more in Canada more than you are in the U.S. I mean, your present president, who, for me, when I was looking at the choices, well, he was the better of two evils. I prefer a rogue who I can understand their roguishness to an ideologue who's malicious. And surely that's what the difference was. And as one of our best journalists, Conrad Black, says, the swamp needs draining, and you often need a brash and arrogant person to do it. Let's hope he does it. And in the process, the Bible study started in the White House might do something good for his soul. The second thing on Scruton's list is loyalty. We the people, our land. Muslims don't have that sense at all, and most Muslim nations are failed states. He's comparing the two. Christianity, which says, give to Caesar the things that are Caesar's and give to God the things that are God's. And he leaves us, as usual, to go and think about that, and we've been thinking about it forever.
Hmm.
He puts irony forth. A lot of people recognize how important this is now. But Christ's judgment and parables look on the spectacle of human folly and wrongdoing and show us how to live with it, make acceptance of it possible. We need self-criticism. We need adversarial law procedures. And his number seven won't go down well with our listeners, but you can think about it. He says free association with a little alcohol. What he's pointing out is that many of us are tongue-tied, and drunkenness is forbidden, but a little wine makes bad the heart of man, and a little for your stomach's sake is probably good news. And certainly so many people do, in fact, when they get together under social circumstances where they don't intend to annoy one another, actually deal with a lot of problems in the past. I don't think we have the beginnings of an understanding of how rich our history is and how saturated it is with Christianity. Flannery O'Connor calls the South where you live the Christ-haunted South. It's a lovely phrase.
Hmm.
Sorry, yeah, I went off on a sermon. You should have stopped me.
I've never learned to do that, John. I want to thank you for your faithfulness. And I mean, how many places you've been, how many times you've spoken, only God knows. And how many conversations in between, and how many students you've spent the night with late. And God has used you mightily in so many people's lives. And let me, on behalf of our 19,000-plus members, say a huge thank you to you and for joining us once again.
Well, thank you very much. And I want a special thank you to those who paid my travel bills to Africa and the place, whose names I do not know, but you will be blessed. Thank you.
If you'd like to get more John Patrick, we've got lots of resources, from CDs to video series to all sorts of things. You can go on our website and just put in his name. It'll give you a listing of those things. Or call our office. Talk to one of our staff. They'd be happy to help you. I can't get enough of John Patrick, and I go back and have to listen again and again because they're so rich and there's so much information that's helpful to us in this world we live in right now.